Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First package in the list, X11-Skel. This is a Slackware-specific package. It's got a bunch of stuff by Patrick Volkerding in it, a couple of generated scripts from XF86config, such as a sample zorg.conf file, which is kind of interesting, I guess, to look at. Like, if you've never had to do a zorg.conf file, this gives you an idea of what one looked like. It isn't pretty. Like, really, honestly, not pretty at all. Just this, in fact, this is one of those configuration files that for me kind of represents what not to do, which is frankly a little bit harsh, but that's just how I feel about it. I feel like this is not a configuration file I would want to hand someone and say, this is what a configuration file looks like. Granted, I think that configuration files are a little bit tough to sort of rationalize and design, because on the one hand, the config file needs to be easy for a computer to parse. That's its honestly its primary function. But especially with zorg.conf, where you did have users having to go in very frequently to adjust it themselves, then you want the configuration file to be easily parsed by humans and easily replicated. And I don't know that this was it. This was pretty darn confusing. There's a lot of terminology that doesn't make sense. There's a lot of references to technology that maybe you're not familiar with yet. There are values here that you're maybe not really sure what they do or how you should obtain the optimal value. It's a big job. And this was a lot. This was a big part of setting up Linux for way too long, really. I mean, this lasted for a long time. People had to deal with zorg.conf files a lot. Now, a lot of early distributions, to be fair, had their own little configuration scripts as an attempt to help the user not have to do all of this themselves, with varying success. I've tried lots of old distributions, and some of them got it right, some of them didn't get it right. And when I say that, I mean that some of them got it right for the particular situation and hardware that I was using at the time, which doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't exactly what someone else needed somewhere else on some other hardware. So it really, there's a lot of variables. I understand and I respect that it's just an insurmountable task. And the fact that the Zorg folks got all of this stuff working, and, you know, in the end, where we are today with X11, what, R7 or something? I mean, it just works for you. It just sets itself up. Astonishing. Amazing. Really, really cool. That said, that's the /etc/x11/zorg.conf-vesa. You can look at it just for reference. It's not really something that you're going to use in real life, I don't think. And the other stuff in this package are shell scripts by Patrick Volkerding. So there's one in user bin zorg setup and user bin xwm config. Zorg setup is the a little shell script that attempts to help you set up X correctly. And I figured I may as well just step through it in a virtual machine where if everything fails, it won't matter. So I'm booting my Slackware machine, my virtual machine, to run level 3. So there's no GUI interface yet. I'm going to log in as bogus. Bogus123 is the password. And then do zorg setup, I guess. And it says, well, only root can configure X. Okay. So I'll do su bogus123 and then zorg setup again. Oops, I missed. There we go. All right, if you like, X can attempt to probe for your video hardware and mouse and write an initial configuration file to /etc/x11/zorg.conf. Would you like to do this? Absolutely, I would. Okay, it did that pretty quickly on this virtual machine hardware. Oh, it's not done. Now you can select a default color depth. See, this is the kind of thing. This is what I'm talking about. Like, through no fault of anyone's, how are you supposed to know this? For a new user or for an experienced user, this just to me seems, I mean, there was just so much trial and error in early X11. And by early, I mean, you know, up until like 10 years ago. So here's, I mean, I've got 24-bit true color, 16-bit pseudo color, 8-bit 256 color, 4-bit 16 color. Okay, so I figure probably modern hardware 24-bit true color is probably safe. So I'm going to hit return. And there's a bunch of output. Wow, that was a lot of output. That doesn't look like that's a success to me, but maybe it is. It looks like it just dumped all of the configuration maybe out to my terminal or something. Let me do a cat on /etc/x11/zorg.conf. And it says there's no such file as zorg.conf in /etc/x11. So I'm gonna assume that didn't work. Let me do an ls of the current directory. Maybe it just saved literally the file to my current directory. No. Okay. I'm gonna try that again. Zorg setup. Yes, I want you to do this automatically. Let's knock it down to 16-bit pseudo color. I don't really feel like that would, and it failed again. Interesting. This is not expected. This is, it did not write the file out to zorg.conf. All right, let's do zorg, let's do man zorg setup. There is no man page for zorg setup. Okay, so that was a bust. That did not work. Let's instead, because zorg is actually already, it's already configured on this virtual machine, so I don't actually have to do this. And maybe that's why it's failing, quite possibly. So instead, I'll do xwm config, and this is another sort of menu-driven process, and it says that I can select a default window manager for X. And I'm doing this again as root, which I think I have to, because it sets this in /etc/x11/xinit. So the ones listed are xinitrc.kde, that's for the KDE Plasma desktop, xinitrc.xfce, the cholesterol-free desktop environment, Fluxbox, Blackbox, WMaker for WindowMaker, FVWM, which we don't really know what that stands for, F something virtual window manager version 2.xx, TWM, which is the tab window manager or the timeless window manager, depending on who you ask, and then Motif. So I'm just going to set it to XFCE, and that's it. It just returns me to the prompt. Now, if I wanted to, I could start X at this point, and it would start XFCE. I don't want to do that because I don't want to do this as root. What you're actually kind of meant to do is edit your /etc/init tab. That's inittab, init tab, which is like your initialization table. And there's a list in here right at the top, default run level, do not set to 0 or 6. Currently the id:3:initdefault: is set. And if I look up just up to the top here, it gives me a list of all the run levels as defined by Slackware. 3 is the multi-user mode. That's the default Slackware run level. But 4 is the x11/wayland with sddm/kdm/gdm/xdm/session/managers. So I could change id:3 to id:4, save that, and then reboot this machine. And then it's going to boot straight to a session manager as appropriate to whatever desktop environment I've chosen, which I don't actually know what that's going to be for XFCE. I think it just defaults to SDDM. Okay, it's rebooted, and yes, that is exactly what it has done. It has defaulted to SDDM, which is a pretty reasonable default, I think. And I'm accidentally trying to log in with... So a peculiarity that I don't know, I have not really looked into how to fix this, but on Slackware, if you have your keyboard set to Dvorak. It'll respect that everywhere except SDDM. I just cannot get SDDM to accept that I have a Dvorak keyboard, and it keeps insisting that I type everything in with a QWERTY keyboard for logging in, which I have to actually look at the keyboard these days. If it's not Dvorak, I have to look at it. So there, I've logged in correctly. Now I am going to quickly set this back to run level 3 because I do not like my virtual machine to boot straight to a graphical environment, because that just isn't always what I want. Okay, so that's that. I'll shut the virtual machine down. So that's XWM config. That works as expected. That's a really handy little helper script. I mean, it's silly because honestly, it's not that hard to set your own .xinitrc file. Really, it's pretty easy. And yet that XWM config thing is just it's just a nice little convenience. It really is. It's nice. Zorg setup, I don't know why that failed. I feel like I've probably used that before in Slackware and it has worked. I'm assuming that it's got something to do with either modern X11 not requiring that level of setup, or the virtual hardware. One of those two. I'm not sure which, and it doesn't matter. But that's a nice little tidy package. Just a couple of helper scripts by Patrick Volkerding. As I've said before, I think Volkerding's shell scripts are highly, they're just functional, they're well commented, they are nice and neat. I've learned so much from reading Volkerding's bash scripts, honestly, that I highly recommend them. If you're getting into shell scripting and you want some good examples, do a find on /etc and then grep the results for Volkerdie, V-O-L-K. Well, actually, probably just V-O-L-K would get you there. And you'll see, or grep-i, Volker. And you'll see a bunch of shell scripts by Volkerding, and they're just, they're really, really good. So I highly recommend. It's a good afternoon read. Next package is X11 perf. This is a performance test of your X11 server. It's not the easiest command to use in a way. You can type in X11 perf, and I believe if you do nothing, yeah, it gives you a whole big long list of options, and it is a long list. I mean, I don't even know how many lines it is. And bizarrely, when I do like X11 perf and pipe that to less, it just skips over. It doesn't go into less. It skips right past less. So it's like one of those weird things, you know, where, I don't know, it somehow escapes the pager. So, and you can do head, doesn't matter. So it's really hard to get, sort of capture all of these options in a digestible way, other than just scrolling through your terminal manually, which, I don't know, it's kind of annoying. So that's a problem. Is there a man page for this? I believe so. Yeah, there is. And the man page says that the program runs one or more performance tests and reports how fast an X server can execute the tests. So if you do X11 perf, and then just choose something, like here's git image 100. Then it pops a window onto your screen that will surely get in your way and kind of annoy you. Upper left-hand corner, it's got a nice little label at the bottom to tell you what test is being run. And depending on what test you've chosen, it might be a bunch of blinky lights, or it might be a bunch of lines drawing back and forth, or it might be just a grid rendered on your screen like it is right now for me. And then in your terminal, you'll see a report on how quickly it was able to do a repetition of the test. This was actually a pretty short test. I've tried some of them that go on for seemingly hours, and certainly if you find, well, not hours, sorry, several minutes. Certainly if you try all of the tests, like if you just trigger all to do it, it'll just go on. Yeah, it will be probably an hour or several hours. I had to end it eventually because I just doubted that it would ever end. But in this case, I've got 240,000 reps at dot 0.0219 milliseconds, 45,700 per second, get image 100 by 100 square. And it did that 2, 4, 6 times. And I'm assuming higher numbers are probably better. I've definitely seen higher numbers on other tests. It really just kind of depends. None of this really means anything to me, so I don't know. You could tell me, oh, you got a score of 10, and I'd be very happy, until I found out that the correct score was 1,000, in which case I would be less happy, unless you then tell me that 10 is better than 1,000 because lower numbers are better. Who knows? I don't know what these mean. All I know is that it draws shapes on your screen and then reports back to you on how quickly it was able to do that. So let's compare the numbers to something. I've got my laptop here. It's running Fedora 40, but I'm going to SSH in from my laptop using SSH forwarding. So I'm going to do SSH-Y, that's trusted X11 forwarding, to my workstation at my desk, the one that I'm recording on right now, and run x11 perf dash get image 100. So the same test. Oh, can't find display. Okay, I must not have that set up correctly. All right, back over on my workstation, I'm going to open up /etc/ssh/sshd underscore config, and then I'm going to locate the values x11 forwarding. Let's change that to yes. Let's uncomment that and change it to yes, just an explicit yes. And then x11 display offset 10. Let's uncomment that. I feel like that should be enough for this. Oh, and then I'm going to need to restart the SSH daemon. So I'll do sudo /etc/rc.d/rc.sshd. And I think in this case, a restart is fine. It does warn you that that doesn't stop the, like, every process if there was something connected, but that's okay. I'm just going to exit. Oop, darn it. I guess I had already exited. All right, I'm going to exit out of that session in my laptop and then open a new one. SSH-Y, and then to the workstation. Okay. There we go. X11 perf dash get image 100. X11 perf dash get image 100. There we go. Okay. That's correct. Okay. So now it has popped up a window on my screen already. It feels slower. Frankly, the sync time adjustment has been 20.9 seconds on the laptop with, you know, in this forwarded session. As a comparison, it was 0.0173 milliseconds for, oh, is that 20 milliseconds? Yeah, okay, 20.9 milliseconds. But still, on my workstation, locally, 0.0173 milliseconds for sync time. And now, oh my goodness, 1,200 reps at 4.8 milliseconds, which is 206 per second for this get image 100 by 100 square. That's on my laptop. Again, on the workstation, 240,000 reps at 0.0219 milliseconds, which is 45,700 seconds. So definitely orders of magnitude better locally, which doesn't feel great for X11 forwarding. I'm not sure exactly how, like, realistic really it would be to do anything very intensive through X11 forwarding. I guess that was one of the big things about, what was it, No X or something like that. Do you remember this? I think it was, No X, I think, was what it was called. It was some kind of forwarding system that someone had come up with where I think it was like you could, was it in X maybe? No X is not coming up. I mean, this might not even exist anymore. I mean, this might not be a thing anymore. But there was this system, probably a couple of systems, to be honest, where I think that instead of forwarding X, it, I don't know, I want to say it, like, grabbed, you know, what X would do on the local computer and just sent that back and mimicked it on the remote, and then mimics it on the local or something, where, you know, so that you're not really forwarding the traffic of X itself. You are forwarding, where you're grabbing onto the calls being made, and you're making it to some, I don't know, local widget set. I could be making this up. Either way, I do know that there were systems for a while that were designed to kind of, I guess, improve upon or circumvent, or, you know, both in a way, X forwarding. But yeah, that performance isn't great. And my network is not terrible. I mean, that is a wired connection, but my router is pretty good. It's a router that I purchased specifically because the old router was not good and I wasn't seeing, you know, even half of the bandwidth that I should have with my fiber connection. So the router I upgraded several years ago now, but I mean, it's quite good. I don't know the specs off the top of my head, but it shouldn't result in a 20 time increase, you know, in minor tasks when forwarding X. So that's not great. That's makes me feel good about my workstation, I guess. I mean, my numbers there were higher than when forwarding. So I guess that's good, but yeah, that is interesting. That's more severe than I would have expected. Okay, so that's X11 perf. It's a performance check. I guess we can talk about XAuth now, which is the next package. And I'm going to talk about XAuth because that's actually one of the things that we just used to do the X11 forwarding. You're not necessarily aware that you've used XAuth when you've used XAuth, but it is happening. It's working in the background. Okay, so XAuth is a way to prove to another computer that yes, you're authorized to do a thing that you want to do remotely, because X11 is designed to accept remote connections, obviously. It can do things like forward an X11 graphic, what would it be, a client? Or am I getting Wayland terminology confused now? I don't know. It can forward a session across a network. So obviously it's designed for remote connections, but at some point you just kind of need to know that this computer that's trying to connect to a running X11 server is indeed authorized to do so. So the one way that they figured out how to do this is that once you have authorized yourself, once you have validated your connection with your password or your SSH key or whatever you're using, XAuth randomly generates a magic cookie and places it into .x authority. When you are making requests of that computer, it compares what it has generated for you, what the magic cookie, with what's in your .x authority file, and if you are indeed authorized, then it permits that connection to happen. You can look at X authority with the cat command, cat --x authority, and you'll get some data. You get your host name, you get MIT magic cookie -1, and then probably some stuff that you can't read. So that's I don't know, hashed or salted, or salted and hashed, I don't know. That's obfuscated in some way. You can look at what's actually, you know, the actual data. You can look at the cookies with the command that comes with this package, XAuth space list, kind of dumps the contents of your .x authority out, except decrypted, so or unhashed or whatever it is. I haven't looked into it. So here's my host name, MIT magic cookie 1, and then some long string of numbers and letters. And here's the other host name, some long string of numbers and letters, and so on. So those are your XAuth. That's what you're authorized, or rather, those are tokens. And those tokens might mean something to some other computer on your network. That's really all that is. I'm trying to think if XAuth comes with... Nope, that is it. That's literally all XAuth comes with. It's just XAuth and the man page for the XAuth application. XAuth, the command, has... I mean, you can do the standard --- health and help and get a list of commands, and you get the idea pretty quickly that it is kind of a maintenance application. Like it's maybe a little bit like a GPG kind of tool where you can use it to curate your key ring, essentially, although it's not a key ring, it's just your .x authority file, but same concept. You can do things like get info about each entry, like XAuth info. You get a location of your XAuth file, whether the file is new or locked, how many entry numbers there are, and so on. You can do XAuth remove to remove an entry from your XAuth file. Admittedly, you can also just go in and edit the XAuth file, but like I say, because it's a little bit mangled, it can be difficult to do that reliably. In practice, if you just ditch your XAuthority file, it's not that big of a deal. It's going to come back when you SSH into another machine, so it doesn't really actually matter. Like, I'm just going to trash /XAuthority, and then, I need to turn on another computer because I closed my laptop. Here we go. So now I'll SSH in from my laptop into the workstation where I have just removed my XAuthority. And of course that works without a problem. That SSH is in just as usual. And then back on my workstation here, I'm just going to do, I guess, a file of /XAuthority. Yes, it exists. Yes, it is a file full of data. So it just gets auto-generated. And if I do an XAuth list now, I've got one entry with a new magic cookie for this machine. So and it's got data like, you know, your host name, your display offset, your magic cookie type, your magic cookie itself. So if you had an XAuthority file with a lot of entries and you wanted to curate it a little bit, you can use XAuth command to do that. But in practice, I think for most people, you won't need to, because like I say, you can just remove it. It'll get a new authentication token after you've provided your password or your pass key or your SSH key. It just gets remade, rebuilt. It doesn't matter. Okay, next package. No coffee. That's where we are. We're at coffee time. So go get some coffee. We'll come back and do more packages. Okay, we're back. We have coffee, I hope. I have coffee anyway. It's very good coffee, as you know. I've raved about it in the previous episode, so there's not a whole lot else to say. I do have more on order from flight. It's going to be, I think, B2 is what I got, I think. Or did I get bomber? I get the two confused for probably obvious reasons. B2 bomber, like it's basically the same thing, but they're two separate coffees. So I always forget which one it is that I like. But I mean, I like both, but I forget. I'm pretty sure it's bomber. We'll find out next week. For now, we're going to keep going through these packages because we got to get through at least 10. X Backlight is the next package. I'm not going to say a whole lot about it because it doesn't work for me. But if you have a screen, I guess, that supports being adjusted through X11 or X Backlight, then in theory, you're able to do something like X Backlight dash set and then some percentage, like let's say 56%. And that ought to dim your backlight by 50. Oh, you know what? No, that should set it to 50 to 56. Let me try -DEC, decrease by 56. No, still no. So I'm just going to go back up to set 100. And there's also a get. So you can set or get. So I'm going to do a -get, and I get nothing in response. So I'm assuming that's telling me that nothing is, that it detects no screens, no supported screens. So I think that's why this isn't working for me. But in theory, you should be able to do that, provided you have the correct setup. All right, after that is XBiff. This is a mail notifier. It's a graphical notification for when you get new email. It only handles mail stored in a file system accessible file. So this isn't going to tell you, it's not pinging a server somewhere over IMAP or POP or whatever to see whether you've gotten email there. This is locally. If something comes in locally, then it can ping you. You'd have to set this up yourself, of course. You know, if you're using Mutt or probably Alpine, then or I guess Xmail or MailX, whatever it's called, then you could set this up. If you just want to see it, you can launch it manually with XBIF, or you could tell it what color to use with -BG and then a color name. You'll recall that those are listed with the RGB command, -FG for the foreground color, so the background versus the foreground being the drawn, you know, the lines that draw, and the background being just the blank space behind it. If you do type in just XBIF, you get a little picture of a mailbox. So that's the notification. On my computer, it just appears in the middle of the screen. So you'd probably want to have this XBIF thing appear somewhere other than just the middle of your screen. And with programs or with window managers like Fluxbox, you have a high degree of control over that. You could put it in the slit. You could put it anywhere you want on the screen. And I guess, I mean, even with KDE with Plasma Desktop, you do have system settings where you can identify a window by regex or by some identifying thing and tell it where to draw that sort of thing. So you do have control over it. I don't think that this is going to be in practice all that useful. However, if you wanted to configure it to work, you can do in your .x defaults, capital X defaults, .x defaults, you can do like xbif asterisk file colon slash home slash clatu or whatever slash mail or wherever you keep your mail slash inbox or whatever you call your inbox file. Then when that file gets updated, presumably when it expands, I don't know, then xbif will trigger that notification. And in xDefaults, you can tell it, you know, you can set things like the geometry of xBIF, xBIF asterisk geometry colon 28x28 instead of 48x48 or whatever its default size is. You can even set its location within xDefaults. I mean, its location on the screen, you know, from assuming 00 is top left, then you have to calculate, well, how many pixels over do you want it from the top left and so on. But you can do that. All of this comes from srob.net/mutt.html. I've never tried it myself. I don't care to. Not something I'm interested in, but it is there. It's an alert that you could use if you needed it. All of these applications, I mean, there's a bunch of things that you're sort of stringing together, right? Mutt doesn't automatically check your email. You need to set a cron job to do that, if I recall correctly. I know that. Mutt does not automatically check your email. What am I talking about? Of course it doesn't. It would have to be running a daemon to do that, and it's not. So you could do a cron job or something like that so that you're checking your email consistently over time, and then you'd have your Mutt application configured, and then you'd have XBIF entered in your xDefaults looking at the file that Mutt is also maintaining as your inbox and so on. So it's a different process, and it's actually kind of a picture perfect explanation of really kind of like what is involved when you decide to build your own system on Linux, or your own subsystem, I guess, arguably on Linux. Because on the one hand, and especially if you're just using modern modern sort of, shall we call them mainstream applications, a lot of those things, they do all of that for you. Like if you're just using Kontakt or Kmail, then there's not a whole lot of setup that you have to do. You have to enter your email account and your password or whatever, your credentials. And then KDE Plasma Desktop checks for you every so often. I mean, maybe there's a configuration where you can change how often it does that. But I mean, all that'll happen. The notification will happen for you up in your system tray or down in your system tray, wherever you keep yours. So it all just kind of happens like normal, quote unquote, like, you know, other computers, like most other computers and mobile devices, it all just happens. And that's a great luxury. But if you're one of those people who are using Linux because you want to design your own Rube Goldberg machines where, you know, one thing triggers another and that triggers another thing, or you just happen to enjoy the lightweight nature of some of these simple applications, then you just have to kind of accept or understand, or both, that these are not all in one solutions. You have to, part of the power of these applications is, well, yeah, they don't do a bunch of stuff that isn't very targeted to what they are meant to do. So Mutt, in other words, does not check your mail for you. You have to open up Mutt and trigger a mail check. Otherwise, it would be running a daemon in the background, and maybe you don't want that. That's not what you're signing up for when you say, I want a lightweight mail client. That just does not, that doesn't equate. So then you have to run something else. Well, luckily you have something else to run. You could do cron, you could do anacron, you could do whatever. You could write a script that does it for you every so often. I don't know why you do that. I just use cron. But you could do that. And then for the notifications, you can choose XBIF or you can choose XBuffy or something else, something of your own design or something else that I just don't know about or can't think of off the top of my head. So there's a lot of just manually connecting the dots. And that's not something that you're necessarily used to if what you're used to is like the quote unquote mainstream stream applications. Neither is right, neither is wrong, or I should say both are right and neither are wrong. It depends on what you're looking for. And I think it's sometimes easy to get lost, you know, or not quite comprehend what people might say. Oh, Linux, you know, this requires a lot of setup. Well, why does it require a lot of setup? Well, maybe it doesn't. Like, maybe you're using it in a way that it shockingly doesn't require a lot of setup. Like, the most recent time I installed Slackware 15, I was on my workstation, which is years ago now, right? But I mean, I was shocked at how little I had to do because I'd settled into a lot of the defaults of Linux. I just started getting used to accepting whatever the developers have given me. And that's a fine place to be. Like, there's no problem with that. It's nice to be able to have the luxury of being lazy. Just, oh yeah, this is fine. Yep, this'll work. And to this day, I don't think on my main workstation I've bothered installing VLC, which I keep saying because that used to be like the automatic first install for me. Like, that was something that I always had to have. And now it's just like, well, whatever. Dragon Player works actually fine for what I'm doing here. I didn't even have to install FFmpeg. It's already there. You know, so there are so many little things that are just like, yep, that's fine. That'll work for me. And that's a great place to be. But at the same time, like, if you want to get deeper into Linux and really, and you want to spend time messing around with it, I think an onlooker can sometimes think, well, what are they doing? Like, what could they possibly be doing for so many hours on a computer? Like, what is going on? Like, what do you have to do? And it's like, well, one thing I have to do is I want to connect my mail client to my cron, to the cron system, and then trigger notifications with this XBIF thing. But actually, I heard about XBuffy, which apparently has better support for multiple mailboxes, so I've really been trying to get that to exactly the right color and the right position on my screen, and so on. So yeah, point being, it can be as complex and as time-intensive as you want it to be, and that in itself is a luxury, right? You have the choice to either really, really geek out and decide this is going to be the system that I design for myself. And I mean, the good news is you can spend hours doing that. And then if you want, you can forget about it for several years. Like, you don't have to think about it. It's set up. It goes. It may be set up for a decade or more. I mean, there are systems on my computer that I have set up that I just don't think about anymore. I do know that they're there. And sometimes I remember, like, I should probably look at that and just remind myself of how it all works. But for years, you can forget about it. And that's cool. That's fun. But if you don't want to forget about it, you want to constantly improve it and change it, you have the luxury of being able to do that as well. You could find alternatives or better ways to do something, cleaner ways to write that code, whatever. It's very cool. Very fun. And this is bizarrely, yeah, a really good example of how that is. Because what could be simpler than getting a notification for incoming email? Like, come on. That's not a big deal, right? Well, it can be if you make it into a big deal. All right, that's XBIF. Let's talk about XBitmaps. This is a, these are miscellaneous XBitmap files. So if we take a look at the var log packages XBitmaps, sure enough, in user include X11 bitmaps, there's just a bunch of little, presumably, bitmap files. So I'm going to copy one path randomly and type in display /usr/include/x11/bitmaps/eschernaut. And sure enough, there's a bitmap of an eschernaut, one of those impossible knots with no beginning and no end. It's a pretty respectable size. I kind of thought it was going to be a lot smaller. I don't remember how to get the size. Well, I do, but not in display. How about identify that file? It is a 216 by 208 XBM, XBitmap. And there's a bunch of things like that. I have no idea what these are for. I couldn't tell you. But if you want a bunch of bitmaps, user include X11 bitmaps. That's where they are. Next package is Xcalc. This one I know inordinately well, and I'll tell you how. So back in the days, and I hate to keep referencing this because it sounds like I'm being nostalgic. I'm really not. I'm just saying earnestly and honestly. There was a time when my main window into Unix was Mac OS X. That was like my entry point into Unix because that's the computer that I had. And I had picked up this book, Learn Unix in 24 Hours or something like that, or 24 Days, whatever. And people used to laugh that I was reading this book and they just thought it was so silly, but I was reading it and absolutely enthralled. I couldn't put the book down. And it was just so cool to be able to open up a Mac OS terminal application and do useful things. Like, that was really cool. And I do think that there's a point when you're learning Unix and Linux that you go from, well, there's a couple of points. The first point is, oh my gosh, what is this application? Like, this terminal thing. It looks like a text editor, but it doesn't act like a text editor. It seems really, really broken if it is a text editor. And I wouldn't even know what to type anyway. And all the obvious things that you can think to type don't seem to render anything useful. So you don't know what to do with it. And then you ramp up and you suddenly start to know, you learn interesting commands, like things that give you a response that you can somewhat understand. You know, things like ls. Ls shows you a list of directories. Wait a minute, I know that list of directories because if I open up my file manager, that's the same directories as that. That's really cool. Okay. That's something that I can understand. So then you learn cd. So you go into a documents folder, for instance, and you do an ls again. There's the list of all your documents. You open up the same folder in your file manager and you realize, yes, you're looking at the same thing. And then you move a file from a to b.txt, and the file magically does it in your file manager. Like, you're controlling it. You're a puppeteer. You're magically manipulating this thing without even touching your file manager. You have now changed how your computer, you know, the data on your computer. Super powerful. You're empowered. You feel excited about what you've just done. But then there's a plateau because you've hit like this point where you can do stupid things in a terminal, but you're not really sure how people could spend much time in a terminal. You know, it was like listing and CDing and maybe a find here and there if you're adventurous. But like, what do you actually do in a terminal? And so you learn a little bit more, and then eventually at some point you get really good at it and you start realizing what exactly you can do in a terminal. And now all of a sudden you're in a terminal every day, all day, whatever. So at some point I was in a terminal and I'd gotten to the plateau, but I was ramping up for the second level up. I was figuring out, okay, what are useful things I could do? What are some really cool tricks I can do? And eventually I stumbled across XQuartz, as you do on Mac OS X, or as you did on Mac OS X. I don't know what they're doing now, but you found that. And that's the X11 environment within the Quartz window manager of Mac OS. And when you figure that out, and there's a bunch of stuff you have to install and enable and, you know, do a lot of work to sort of turn on this magic thing that Apple, the company, was advertising as like this huge benefit of switching over to Mac, is that you would get all this Unix power, but then they hid the Unix power away, you know, in a back room and made you really work to get it. So after you finally get to that point and you launch X, you have, I believe, a menu with like two applications in it. One is Xcalc, and the other, I think, was like Xclock or something, you know, or yeah, no, it would have had to be Xclock. And maybe Xedit, maybe. Probably not. But anyway, you have like two applications and you're just like, wow, this is not exciting at all. So you've hit another plateau and then you have to figure out how to use some kind of application to install Unix applications in a little file system like the Fink project or MacPorts or Homebrew now, whatever. But that's a different story. That's going too far. The thing that I'm saying is that Xcalc was one of those applications that while I was still figuring out like what exactly you could do with all of these Unix tools that you had, one of the tools that just kept coming up, because every time you tried something with X11, it would be there in the menu, was Xcalc. So I've used Xcalc more than probably you would have thought. Like, it just, I don't know why, but it just, it kind of became a mainstay for me. When I needed a calculator, Xcalc was often the one that I would go to, because I would have been running that. This was years ago, so I'm speaking about a bunch of outdated things that probably don't even apply anymore, but that was my early experience. And Xcalc, I mean, I've already said more about this than really should be possible. Xcalc is a calculator. It's not a particularly great calculator. Like, these days I just use Kcalc, but Xcalc is there. It does exist. XCB Proto is the next package. This is the X protocol, the C language binding protocol specifically. So this is X C language binding protocol, or bindings, I guess, probably. So this is libxcb. It generates the majority of its code and API for the C language. If you're writing C code and you're writing for the X11, for X11, you're going to be using XCB. Next up is XCBUtil. These are utility libraries for the XC bindings. You've seen utility functions before, probably. I mean, if not in real life, then on this podcast, they exist, they do things, not a whole lot to say about them. There's like XCBUtilCursor. This is the cursor module for XCB, which is the XCB replacement for just straight libxcursor. XCBUtilErrors provides useful error messages. UtilImage, UtilKeySim, UtilRenderUtil, UtilWM for window management. These are all libraries, and they're all doing a lot of work for programmers who would otherwise have to manually write functions for actions that are reasonably expected to be fairly common when you're developing. This is the kind of thing that you love to see as a programmer, because yeah, you do have to kind of like learn that library. You have to understand, well, what functions are available to me? Why does this library exist? But the moment that you do, like, I think mostly the moment you realize why the library exists, then you can kind of, you know, you just search through the library for the function that, if that is its purpose, then surely there would be a function to do this or that. And so you search for that, you find the function, and then you use it, and it's great. You'll see this kind of thing in frameworks and in IDEs all over the place. It's such a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's the power, once more, power of open source. Sure, other, you know, SDKs do exist. Like, you can buy into an SDK from Microsoft or Apple or whatever system. But with open source, you get the SDK, and then you get everybody else's SDKs. You know, like, everybody else who's ever thought, oh, I really need to get the exact pixel location of that one button, regardless of how the user has configured their screen or something like that. Don't worry, there's a library for that. There's a function in that library. So yeah, it's really nice. It's very, very useful. And the next application is XClipboard. This comes with two commands, XClipboard and XCutCell. So XClipboard is just, it's a clipboard manager. So if you want to copy something, when you copy something, it appears in XClipboard. You can have lots of sort of pages in XClipboard. You can remove, I say pages, I guess entries maybe. I mean, it kind of looks like pages because it has a little number that you can increment, like new, now you're on page 4 instead of page 3 or however many there are, and you can flip through them, previous, next, next, next. So you can, you know, if you've ever seen a clipboard manager, this is basically this is known to you. This is a clipboard manager. You get an entry and you can flip through the different entries, and the one that you are currently on becomes the primary clipboard entry. So for instance, if I type the word foo, and then with my cursor, I'm typing into my terminal. With my cursor, I'm going to select foo. I don't know what I hit there. I'm going to right click and hit copy. And now in XClipboard on page 1 is the word foo. So that's the primary selection. I'll delete this from my terminal. Now I'm going to hit Control Shift V. I paste, and the word foo appears in the terminal. That's because that's the primary selection. Okay, well, now I'm going to type in the word hello, or the words hello world. Once again, with my cursor, I'm going to select that, right click, and copy. Okay, so now XClipboard has changed to hello world. If I look at it, I'm on page 2 now. So this is the second entry, hello world. If I go to the previous, it's foo. So with my XClipboard open to foo, Control Shift V, the word foo appears. With my clipboard set to next, hello world, Control Shift V, I've just pasted in hello world. That's your primary selection. So if I wanted to then, if I launch XCutCell, this is a very simple application, and I'm not entirely sure really why it exists personally. I don't quite get the use case here, but XCutCell copies either the primary selection to the cut buffer or the cut buffer back over to the primary selection. So if currently, currently if I hit Control Shift V, then I've just pasted hello world. So hello world is my primary selection. Now I guess I will, now I can't figure out a good way to do this. So I could copy primary to 0. And now Control Shift V, still hello world. I don't know exactly what the cut buffer is really, really good for. And the man page doesn't give me a whole lot of a clue. I mean, it says the XCutCell program is used to copy the current selection into a cut buffer and to make a selection that contains the current contents of the cut buffer. It acts as a bridge between applications that don't support selections and those that do. Okay. So I think that actually just means, let's see, if I select XCutCell in the terminal and then go over to, well, maybe that's a bad. I'll select the word buttons. So I've just selected it. I haven't copied it, haven't pasted it, haven't done anything with it. But you and I know that if I were to hit the middle mouse button, buttons would appear, would get pasted in, right? Because that's how X works. It's got that secondary buffer, that secondary copy buffer, the selection buffer. So I've got buttons selected, the word buttons, and now I'm going to copy primary to 0. And now I'm going to deselect buttons. So buttons is no longer selected. And if I do a Control Shift V, I get foo. All right, well, that did not work the way that I thought it was going to work. No, that did not. Okay, yeah, I don't know. I don't know the use case for XCutCell. It's quite possible that there is no real use case for this, because maybe modern Linux applications just handle that on their own, possibly. I don't know. But that's XClipboard and XCutCell. Don't know what XCutCell is. But hey, the package ain't named XCutCell. It's named XClipboard. All right, let's really quick here talk about XClock. That is exactly as it sounds. It is a clock, a square clock, rather than O clock, which, as you'll recall, was a round clock. as you can imagine, there are options for background and foreground. So you could do something like X foreground. Oh, that didn't work. Let's try X foreground white. No, wow. Maybe the foreground isn't working. I'm not sure why that's not working. The foreground color does not seem to be working right now. Am I doing this wrong? FG color. Yeah, no, it should be. Oh, maybe, you know what? It must be maybe HD color instead of, yeah, it must be HD color. No, I don't know. I don't know how to get the foreground to work. That's really interesting. Okay, yeah, I'm just getting, yeah, all right. Well, supposedly you can control the colors, although, as I've said, like on O'Clock, I was able to change the colors. But in X'Clock, I can change the background color successfully, but not the thing that is being rendered, the time markers and the hands. I don't know how to change those to different colors. But you can change X'Clock between the analog option, which is the default, or a digital option. So if you do X'Clock-digital, then you just get the time. It's not like a LED looking clock face or anything. You get a date and a time and your time zone, which is kind of nice. It is a little bit quirky because, I mean, what are you gonna use to launch a window just for this? Probably not on a modern system, but I mean, you could embed it into something on some window managers and have that displayed there. So that seems relatively useful. And then finally, I think for this episode, we've got libx, or rather XCM, which contains, and XCM SDB, I guess. So these are color utilities and color libraries for X11. This specifically, XCM is able to parse EDID data, or I guess I'm probably being redundant. I don't remember what EDID stands for. Let's look it up really quick. EDID, Extended Display Identification Data. So it can parse EDID, and EDID is literally, it's like a handshake between your display device and your operating system, your operating system. And it's a way for your, you know, this is how things understand the capabilities of a specific monitor. So this is how information like color, you know, bit depth and resolution and all that stuff is conveyed between devices. EDID is a standard form of metadata, and XCM specifically for color, I guess, queries or receives the EDID metadata, parses it, and uses it as X11, or makes it available to X11 to use. XCM SDB is the command, I mean, a separate package, but the package XCM SDB just contains this one command, and that is used to query data that you know, the EDID metadata. This command I can't really work with. I mean, I can't do anything with it because it does require a DCC file, a color characteristic, color characterization data file. And I don't have any of those. I've searched the system for one, but I just can't. Now, the fact that I need a .cc file at all was something that I spent several minutes determining. Because none of the documentation says that. XCM SDB doesn't tell you what kind of file it wants at all. It says that you can feed it a file or standard input, and that's as much information as it gives you. It doesn't tell you what kind of file. It just says a file or standard input. If you look through the documentation of Xlib, I didn't find anything about any of this. It took me. I ended up on like a developer.ibm or, you know, IBM developer documentation happened to have an example of a successful command, and it had a DCC, a .DCC file. And that was the only place I found any indication of what XCM SDB actually expected as input. I don't feel, and I've complained about this already, so I don't want to go on too much about this, but I really do feel like X11 documentation is not set up for user success. Instead of the documentation demonstrating and explaining how to use the commands, it just feels like the documentation is treated as gentle reminders for something that surely you already know. And if you don't know, I guess good luck. Maybe there's an expectation that you do just sit down with literally all of the documentation of X11 and read it and learn it before attempting to interact with X11. That quite possibly could be. And that's, you know, in a way somewhat reasonable maybe, because maybe they don't expect users to be using XCMSDB at all. I mean, and that's reasonable. I think these are developer focused commands. And I guess a developer, in order to be useful while working on X11, would need to know the underlying technology. That said, I'm hard pressed to believe that there's no way to explain this in, even if it's just prefaced with, you know, if you're not a developer, you should not need this command. We can think of no use case where a user would require output from this command, but here's how it works. Here's what you need. If you don't have these things, then here's the documentation to read more about those things and how to get them and so on. So I think there's a way to do it. I don't think it was ever done. And because X11 is functionally being sunsetted, I don't believe it's ever going to happen. I don't think that's necessarily a good or a bad thing. It's just the state of things. Like I say, maybe I'm just not the audience, but I think that is something to keep in mind going forward. I think documentation could be done better. Just broadly speaking, I think it could be done better. And I think we need to do better at it. Because at the end of the day, as we've seen, open source, people don't care so much about the dollar price. Like, it's great. But they can pirate the software that they want anyway, so who cares? Or they refuse to pirate and are just willing to pay. Or they can, so the price doesn't matter, the open sourcedness doesn't matter, because most people don't look at the source code anyway, so whether it exists or not, they don't care. One of the major things that we have going for us as open source enthusiasts is the ability to share. And sharing isn't just dumping a bunch of free applications on someone's desk and walking away. Sharing is providing the open source applications and guidance on how to make it amazing. That's the important thing. That's being an open source enthusiast. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.